Talking about the systemic racism that restrains black families from much of the stability and prosperity that the American middle class enjoys means confronting a lot of things that have happened with money over the years. A lack of access to capital for black people is a fact of life, whether you're buying a home or a car, maybe starting a business or getting ready for your kids' education. And Metro Detroit is perhaps as good a place as any in these United States to see and talk about what's happened over the decades and even centuries. Author, educator, and activist Herb Boyd has written about 24 books about black history and culture, among them Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. He joins us now. Herb Boyd, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks, April. It's good to be with you.
Herb, I think it's hard for some white people to look at Detroit and see what happened with all the economic opportunity of the 1940s, and to look at the boom years that immediately preceded this pandemic shutdown, looking around and seeing all the change in the city, the businesses, the new housing. And they can't always put together why and how the full measure and the full benefit has been denied to black Detroiters. How do you start to talk about the structural forces at work here?
It's a very complicated and challenging, difficult situation to sum up. We need a lot of time to do that because it's taken a lot of time for this situation to kind of develop or evolve into what it is today. I think the overarching, and if you're going to put it in historical perspective, is always to keep in mind that the U.S. continues to be suffering from a very, very deep systemic racism. You might say the body politic is infected with this systemic racism. And it's going to take a while to remove it because the pandemic, as well as the so-called Great Recession, has kind of made that situation of disparity, racial disparity, income inequality, even more transparent. But you know, this situation has been festering for years. And, of course, if you take and see Detroit as being symptomatic or symbolic of that, and I certainly do, the situation there as it pertains and as it existed over the years is a condition that is widely shared by other communities and municipalities in this country.
Can you talk to us about the confluence of black populations seeking wealth, maybe during the Great Migration, and the violence that those wealth seekers faced?
Oh, yeah. The Great Migration is a very historical milestone in American history. I was a part of it. My mother brought me and my brother to Detroit just a few months before the race riot of 1943. In effect, April, that was my introduction to Detroit. It's suddenly, boom, you know, this.
Right.
Cataclysm that swept across the city at that time. And of course, my mother, she actually experienced a very brutal situation in which a black man was kind of gunned, his body shot in half out on Holbrook and Russell Street. One of the things we can say about, you know, these riots or rebellions that we've had, no matter where they occur in this country, it takes years of recovery. Because what you've experienced, you know, first of all, you have like the fissures that occur in race relations, compounded by, you know, personal and property loss, those kind of things, and job loss, all those things, you know, taken together makes it very difficult for recovery. I think that Detroit almost systematically has undergone almost with each generation a kind of upheaval, a disturbance that have torn the fabric of the city apart and made it very difficult for employment and the whole production, manufacturing. Of course, with the 1940 situation, particularly with the arsenal of democracy, because World War II was going on at that time, so many African Americans, you know, had prosperity opportunities because they got job opportunities that did not exist before. And so you have Detroit as like an epicenter in terms of the manufacturing boom of these automobile plants being converted into munition plants. So that was another part that spurred, you know, even before that, if you go back to the 1920s with Henry Ford, his $5 a day offer, that spurred migration in this country. You know, when you look at the paradox of it all, that it has both positive and negative aspects. So we kind of focused on the positive end as opposed to the kind of systemic racism that was very, very apparent.
How explicit were some of the covenants and rules, both in housing and finance, that really put restrictions on what Black families could achieve in those years after the Great Migration?
You know, you had a white population that was not that receptive in many parts of the city, that we could not just choose to live where we wanted to live. You had neighborhood, you know, organizations that blocked that. You had a government that was predisposed to do little or nothing. So we had these conditions over the years in which the African-American community is like met with all kind of opposition. Can you get the loans? Were the banks receptive? You know, how is your credit rating? You know, what's your background and history? So accumulating wealth, of course, home ownership is just absolutely critical in that process. We were denied those opportunities and possibilities. So all of that hampered our opportunities to grow and join that kind of so-called flourishing middle class, although many of us, because of our perseverance and our determination, did enter into the kind of growing middle class of the city of Detroit.
I know that you're a student of Malcolm X, and you knew him when he lived in Detroit. How did his teachings about Black wealth influence your own ideas?
My goodness. Well, for me, in terms of my political development, the kind of consciousness that I've had in that regard, it all pretty much started with Malcolm X. What happened was is that if you go back to when I was 19, 20 years of age and really interested in developing myself as an intellectual, as a writer, you know, Malcolm came into my life. And whenever he visited Detroit, you know, after I had been introduced to the Nation of Islam, I made it my business to be there to hear him. So when he was scheduled to come to Detroit in February the 14th, 1965, to speak at Ford Auditorium, at that time I was working at Dodge, Maine in Hamtramck, and working the graveyard shift, as they call it. And when I heard that his house had been firebombed earlier that morning, I just took it for granted that Malcolm would not be coming to Detroit. Well, lo and behold, much to my chagrin, he arrived and spoke at Ford Auditorium, and friends of mine told me that they could smell the smoke on him because all he could salvage from his house in East Elmhurst was what he had on. And so I made my mind, April, at that point, that what I was going to do, if he could go through all of that and in the early morning hours of the 14th and get on a plane and come to Detroit, you know, I'm going to New York. And then within days of my preparation to depart, he was assassinated on the 21st, a week after his house was firebombed. Mm. Oh, I say, my goodness, you know, I just couldn't bear to go to the funeral at that time. I made it my business to say, okay, I'm going to continue his journey and get my education together.
Right. Malcolm X talked about Black wealth as something that was really integral in his view to Black liberation. And he was very, very emphatic about the importance of money staying within the community. Can you tell us a little bit about how that influenced your own ideas about economics and how it might work in a place like Detroit?
Well, all of that is part and parcel of what Malcolm was talking about in terms of his Black nationalism. You know, he was saying that, of course, you know, he was a convert of the Nation of Islam. He was mentored by Elijah Muhammad. Muhammad, of course, had grew out of Marcus Garvey, Noble Drew Lee, and a number of other Black nationalists who all began to talk about Black empowerment. We talked about self-determination, about doing for self, you know, particularly in view of the kind of hostility, the racism, discrimination, oppression they faced coming from the larger society. You had no other option, no alternatives but to kind of build your own stores, you open up your own businesses and do for yourself. So all of that grew out of the Nation of Islam. And of course, Malcolm coming into that context was imbued with those same ideas. His black nationalism was like expressed a much larger tableau, you might say, because it had not only the economic, it had the social cultural components as well built into it. So when he talked about blackness, when he talked about black nationalism, he was talking about, you know, overall philosophy that had economic, political, and social potentialities. And he played all those things up wherever he talked. So all of this is part and parcel of Malcolm's overall philosophic approach, one that he maintained right to his death, even though he had begun to incorporate the Muslim faith into all of that.
Herb Boyd is an author, an activist, and an educator who grew up in Detroit and has written many books about black history and black theory, and who taught for many years at City College in New York. And he's among his other books, he's the author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination, which is about as good as a starting guide to living in Michigan as this newcomer has ever seen. Herb Boyd, please keep safe, and thank you so much for talking to us on Stateside today.
It's good to talk to April in August.
I'm here all year.
Thank you, baby. Bye-bye.